Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker in London.
Also in London, I'm Gala Riani. Welcome to the podcast.
Gala, this week's Risk Map Podcast reminds all of us where the podcast actually gets its name. Just this week on the 12th of December, Control Risks released Risk Map 2017, our annual global forecast of political, security, and operational risk. Control Risks has been publishing Risk Map for more than 20 years, and over that time it has developed into a multimedia website with video, podcasts, infographics, and articles all written by our global team of political risk analysts. See the Risk Map website at riskmap.controlrisks.com. For the full picture.
For the next few podcasts, we're going to highlight content from the Risk Map website and interview the analysts who produced our annual forecast. But first, Risk Map 2017 opens with a welcome video from our CEO, Richard Fenning. Richard's comments on the ubiquity of risk in 2017 points to some of the changes to the very nature of risk itself in the coming year. I caught up with Richard, who's in Singapore, where he shared some of his remarks with me.
Richard, in our Risk Map 2017, you kick us off with quite a sobering look at the risk landscape that our clients face. Maybe you could start off with talking us through some of the central themes of that piece.
Well, not surprisingly, Risk Map 2017 is preoccupied by this big question about the rise of populism and the anti-globalization agenda. Lots of other things we talk about in Risk Map, of course. This is not the only theme by any means, but it is the sort of issue of the day. It's what's dominating people's thinking as 2016 draws to a halt. So that's very much the sort of central theme that we are trying to explore. I guess what we're trying to do is not be preoccupied by being in the speculation business about exactly what may or may not happen in the United States or in Europe, but try and look at some of the kind of underlying drivers of what is creating some of these political surprises and upsets. I guess as we get towards the end of the year, we're in a kind of rather strange period. We're in a kind of hiatus. So Donald Trump is now president-elect. He's won the election, but he's still got a few weeks to go before his inauguration and before he takes office. Similarly in Europe, the British electorate has voted for Brexit, but we're still some way off the triggering of Article 50. And we're also waiting to see what will happen in the French election, what will potentially happen in the German election, which will give us, I guess, an indication of whether this tide of populism is growing larger, is accelerating, or whether it's actually subsiding. So we're in this unusual period where all these things have been seemingly unleashed on the world, and yet to date there is nothing of any real consequence that we can get our teeth into. Hence, there's a sort of endless speculation that kind of fills the void. We're all kind of like Kremlinologists watching the latest addition to the President Trump cabinet and trying to sort of draw conclusions as to whether the fact that potentially the future Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson's close ties to President Putin as chief executive of ExxonMobil is somehow going to be an indicator of American foreign policy. The reality is we really don't know. As Napoleon's famous dictum about no plan survives the first encounter with the enemy, well, I suspect all of our speculations may not survive the first encounter of political reality once the new cabinet takes charge in Washington. But for now, certainly markets remain buoyant. Wall Street seems to be giving President-elect Trump the green light. I think probably focused on the prospect of tax cuts, possibility of deregulation, a big infrastructure spend. But I guess if there is an issue that really shines out of the fog, it's this prospect of a full-blown trade war between the United States and China. We, of course, don't know that that is going to happen. There have been a lot of hyperbole and a lot of commentary on both sides. But I think if that was to materialize, that is the issue above all else that would really shape the risk landscape for 2017.
And you say actually in your piece, and we and others often define and have certainly in the past, and sort of our clients, define risk by geography, by the distance on a map. But we're increasingly saying that that's no longer the best measure, certainly not the only measure of risk.
I think that's right, Gala. It's not the only measure of risk. And I think that's the point. So if you look at a part of the world that's close to your heart and that of many of our clients, the Middle East, there's something quite sort of depressingly familiar about the conflict in Syria, for instance. That does feel like a civil war in a nation. It feels like great power intervention in the affairs of other countries. It has the hallmarks of things that have been happening in one form or another, sadly, for centuries. So what you describe, you know, the way in which the more exotic, the further it is away from home, the riskier it is still borne out, of course, in some circumstances. Mm-hmm. But there is something else at work here, and that is a much more sort of fundamental shift, that risk has become ubiquitous, and it's technology that drives that, of course. The fact that all of our mobile telephones, brilliant though they are at allowing us to lead easier and more connected lives, they're also pregnant with risk and peril. And we see that in the way that the sort of democratic nature of the cyber risk, that it really isn't determined by geography and poor governance and poor GDP numbers. It is completely universal. We see that also in the way that many of our clients are struggling to meet the demands of regulators who are kind of re-energized in their desire to reassert fiscal sovereignty in the face of globalization. That doesn't seem to follow the old paradigm, the old pattern of where risk occurs. So I think the point that I hope we try to illustrate and explore in Risk Map is that there's lots of old-fashioned risk at large in the world, but there is this new characteristic as well, that to think of the world, to divide or to calibrate risk in that way is no longer adequate. And cyber, of course, is the sort of standout example of that. But it's not the only example. We see it too in terrorism. Of course, terrorism has always struck in certain parts of the world more than others. And it's certainly been a kind of a Western problem for a long time. But there's something about the current methods by which individuals are radicalized to the extent that they're prepared to do extreme acts of violence that is different to before. It no longer always requires them to be part of an organization, to be under the kind of command and control of a group of people trying to orchestrate events from afar. The internet as a tool of self-radicalization is having an extraordinary impact on people who, for whatever reason, feel as if they've slipped out of the net of society, possibly due to mental health issues, possibly just due to a sense of acute alienation. And those people, hard to detect by intelligence agencies, hard to spot in society sometimes, are a new cadre of terrorists that are going to be with us, you know, perhaps permanently, but certainly for a generation or so. So many of the ways in which, maybe the mindsets of how we've approached understanding risk and then devising strategies to cope with it and to meet the challenge of it are no longer adequate. And I think Risk Map gives people an opportunity to sort of engage with new ways of thinking about how risk impacts our daily lives.
And I actually think that you just touched on the million-dollar question there. You know, how can companies actually respond to this uncertain landscape?
It's tricky, of course, because there is no universal methodology that you can plug into your computer and suddenly your organization, your company is going to have some extraordinary ability to be able to manage their affairs in this somewhat fractured and confused world. But one starting point is for people to understand what kind of organization they are, what is their appetite for risk. In RiskMap, we've given organizations labels to try and help people identify what kind of strategies they might deploy. And we've called those ARCs, sharks, and whales. ARCs are those organizations who, in the face of tumult and uncertainty, build themselves an ARC, climb aboard, take on provisions, hoard themselves full of cash, and basically try to sail out the turbulence of the next few years. Sharks, as the name suggests, are those organizations actually see advantage in a world in which prices are fluctuating, currencies are fluctuating, valuations are all over the place, and really try to be kind of on the offensive, trying to find opportunities, trying to take advantage of uncertainty. And finally, whales are those organizations that think size is what matters in this kind of environment. And it's a question of merging, of acquiring, essentially becoming kind of too large to fail in a period where we are going to have this sort of roller coaster of political surprises probably with us for at least another year or so. So there is something about people taking the time to think, what kind of organization are we? What is our strategy to be able to deal with uncertainty? And I guess for all companies, whichever category, whether you're an ARC, a shark, or a whale, is to have that sort of lean muscle tone that you need to be resilient in this kind of environment. It interests me how sometimes organizations have difficulty thinking about unusual situations. So even though many people were predicting that Donald Trump would not become president of the United States, there was still a sizable minority of opinion that said he would or that he could. And it's extraordinary how few people really went through the mental process of thinking about that as a possibility and what it might do to the environment, what it might do to international trade. And I think we at Control Risks are always trying to encourage people to think through different solutions, different scenarios of what might happen. A very strong sense that organizations that are prepared to do that, that are prepared to countenance surprise and shock results, are the ones that will have the adaptability and the flexibility to be able to prosper when other people may possibly be sort of caught wrong-footed by the fact that the world has gone off in an unusual tangent that they weren't anticipating.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you very much, Gala.
Gala, thanks. The topic of cyber risk is one that's only gained in prominence in the past few years. Almost everybody on the planet, it seems, has a footprint on the internet, leaving trails of information, some of it quite sensitive, everywhere they go. The emergence of big data, the compiling and analyzing of the world's internet footprint, is one of the more interesting developments in cyberspace. How that data is stored and transmitted is a topic of significant risk for 2017. I spoke with Rose Bernard from our cyber threat intelligence team here in London. Rose, first let's start with some definitions. Can you tell me what data nationalism really means?
Yeah, absolutely. Data nationalism is quite a new term, although the phenomenon has kind of been growing over the past few years. But essentially, it refers to the move by a country or a region to keep the data of that country or that region's population within national borders. The idea being that, for example, if you are a European, then your data must be saved on servers kept within Europe's national boundaries.
Rose, what kind of obstacles does this create for companies that are working internationally? I mean, in the past, we saw data protection, data transfer, and data storage regulation moving in an international direction. Is this something in a completely opposite direction?
Yes, it is, really. And it's really interesting how that has done sort of an about take, because if you look at it, it actually does stop companies transferring data globally automatically. So if you are a global company with customers in, for example, the European Union and the US, it means that you can't share that data automatically. You have to go through particular steps and legislative boundaries and meet conditions in order for you to transfer that data.
So basically, this is something that's going to make the regulatory environment, particularly as concerns cyberspace, more difficult for companies that want to operate in a more or less borderless fashion.
Yes, absolutely. You are essentially going to have to impose borders for your data.
I guess the issue is here that there will be countries, perhaps, that will try to make the rules intentionally difficult for international players. Is there a chance that data nationalism is one of the forms of economic nationalism and can be used to treat different companies different ways?
That's a really, really interesting question. And I would say that right now, we're not seeing it being used to target specific companies or nations, but absolutely in the future, that's a way that it could be developed. It could be used to give preferential trade agreements, for example, or to bias economic trade in terms of one country over another.
Rose, how are you seeing companies adapt to this changing landscape? What are they doing or what are they going to have to do in the future to compensate and to negotiate a fairly patchworky set of regulations?
Well, the next couple of years are going to be quite difficult for companies operating globally, I think, because they struggle to come to terms with all of these different regulations. I would say that the first thing for companies to do is have a really good idea of what data they hold and where that data comes from and where it's going to. So to conduct a full audit on all of the data they hold. Once that's in hand, they can then look at the individual agreements and legislation that they have to align with in terms of countries and nation-state regulations. It also means that they're going to have to, for example, keep EU regulations for EU citizens, even when that data has not been held in the EU or when that EU resident is not in the EU. So it's really important that they know exactly what they hold. The years of being able to say, yes, well, we transfer our data to a third party are over.
Rose Bernard, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, in 2017, we anticipate that Iraqi forces will restore their control over the city of Mosul. Now, with that move, certain threats will be resolved. But longer-term problems put on hold during the Mosul offensive will resurface, and they'll bring Iraq full circle to some of the issues that have dogged the country for years. I spoke to our Iraq analyst, Glenn Ransom.
Glenn is based in our Dubai office, and he was very recently in Baghdad. Glenn, you wrote a piece for RiskMap. It was called Iraq After Mosul, All Divisions Renewed. Could you please tell us a little bit about the article and why we decided to write it?
Thanks, Gala. The article was written really to highlight that while the recapture of Mosul from Islamic State has been the focus of the Iraqi authorities and the international community really since it was seized in 2014, that we should really be looking at the legacy of Islamic State's occupation of territory within Iraq, and particularly Mosul, and the consequences in terms of exacerbating existing divisions and long-standing disputes between domestic parties within Iraq. So our view is that after government-aligned forces push Islamic State out of Mosul, likely over the coming year, we will see Islamic State revert to tactics we've seen in previous years, moving into rural areas of north central and western Iraq and renewing its insurgency through re-infiltrating some of its historic strongholds. In addition, the issue of the disputed territories between the Kurdistan Regional Government and the federal government in Baghdad will reemerge as we see federal troops as well as the popular mobilization units and the Kurdish Peshmerga, among other smaller forces, all deployed along the disputed territories around Mosul and across the front lines between previously Islamic State-held territory and the Kurdistan region. Furthermore, the inability of the federal government and the Kurdistan Regional Government to protect religious and ethnic minorities in Nineveh Province in 2014 is likely to see calls for increased autonomy as well as a devolution of power to local districts and Nineveh Province in order to give them increased local control over administration and security provision. this could cause other provinces to also seek further powers, leading to significant resistance within the federal government and an increasingly complex operating environment, particularly in Nunavut province. Finally, we are likely to see the political tensions in Baghdad increase over the coming year as the opposition parties, particularly members of parliament affiliated with Nouri al-Maliki, renew attempts to weaken Abadi's government through the removal of his allies in the cabinet. At the same time, we're also likely to see increased agitation by prominent Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr as he agitates for reform and attempts to increase his influence against the political status quo.
So clearly there's a lot going on in Iraq still, and it's going to be quite a difficult situation. So Glenn, one final question. I know you're in Baghdad recently. For businesses that are currently in the country or looking to enter the country, are they being affected by this? Is it business as usual, essentially? What's happening?
So the organizations that I spoke with who are based in Baghdad primarily, it really seemed like business as usual for them, as well as from the perspective of companies operating in the southern provinces and central provinces. Really, everyone is very much watching the military operations around Mosul, but day to day, it's not having a security impact or operational impact on those businesses that are focused in Baghdad and then to the south, as well as those that are working away from the front lines in the Kurdistan region, though there is obviously an increase of internally displaced people in the Kurdistan region, but this is not having significant effects on the business environment.
Okay. Glenn Ransom, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Gala.
Gala, thanks. Before we sign off, here's a look at some of the other topics we'll be talking about in the coming weeks.
How has the world's risk environment changed, and what are the coping mechanisms available to companies? We'll talk with Jonathan Wood, our Director of Global Issues, in an upcoming podcast.
What's on the agenda at the Communist Party of China's National Congress next year, and how will Xi Jinping embark on his second term as president? We'll be talking to Andy Gillum, our senior China analyst, in an upcoming podcast.
Will President-elect Donald Trump redefine the United States' relationship with Russia? Emily Ferris, our Russia analyst, will let us know. So that's it for the early December edition of the Risk Map podcast. Don't forget to visit the Risk Map website on riskmap.controlrisks.com. You'll even see me there in a video describing the investment climate in post-conflict countries. This is Gala Riani in London. Thanks for listening.
Gala, thanks for co-hosting and thanks for the chat. This is our last podcast for 2016, so I'd like to thank everyone who's clicked and listened over the past year and wish you all a happy, prosperous, and peaceful 2017. We look forward to getting back on the microphones in early January. Until then, bye for now from London.